Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Zero-tolerance school discipline policies emerged in the mid-90s after the passage of a federal law aimed at keeping weapons out of school buildings. States enacted laws to meet those federal requirements, and local districts were largely left to interpret those mandates. The result, a drastic increase in the number of suspensions and expulsions, sometimes for seemingly mild offenses. Derek Black, who teaches law at the University of Carolina, has written a book about the issue entitled Ending Zero Tolerance, The Crisis of Absolute School Discipline. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show, Derek Black.
Thank you so much for having me on.
What do we mean by zero tolerance? Is it an official term or just one to describe something?
I think it's just something that we use to describe something. In fact, in my book, I often use the term zero tolerance and overly harsh punishment. I think people bandy it around. But zero tolerance most specifically means there's a rule that says if you do X misbehavior, you are automatically punished no matter what. That would be zero tolerance. I use overly harsh discipline as a phrase as well, because sometimes the policy may not actually mandate suspension or expulsion, but schools increasingly suspend and expel students anyway.
What do you know about where that penchant to do that comes from?
Well, I think there's two things going on, and one of them is fear, I think, and the other is the pressure that schools are under. So the fear is a normal human reaction. When we see a tragedy like what happened at Columbine back in the 90s or even Sandy Hook more recently, we fear for our children's safety. That is a normal human reaction. But the data still shows us that school is the safest place kids can be. It's safer than being at home. Kids are more likely to fall down and hurt themselves at home than they are at school. They're more likely to get in a fight with their brother and sister and need a trip to the emergency room than they are to get in a fight at school and hurt themselves. So schools are still safe. And I think sort of the imagery that we see on TV, the stories that we hear and the news, those things make us fearful. But that doesn't make fear rational. In fact, fear is often irrational. So that's one place that it comes from. I think the other is really the pressure that schools are under. We passed No Child Left Behind Act about a decade and a half ago, and we told schools that your funding, your structure, your teaching force is going to have this accountability for how students perform on standardized tests. And if they don't perform well, there's going to be sanctions on the school. So schools feel, I would say, sort of an unnecessary pressure or sort of a problematic pressure to produce these results. And when they perceive a child, rightly or wrongly, to be interfering with other people's progress, that pressure on the school to perform says, let's just get them out of here. Let's just get the problem out of here. Let's not worry about whether that makes sense. Get them out of here. I've got a job to do, and that's to educate these other kids.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the emergence of zero-tolerance discipline policies in the nation's schools. It's just as true in Ohio as it is anywhere else. And we'll dig a little deeper into those Ohio statistics coming up later on in the program. Right now, I'm talking with Derek Black. He's a professor of law at the University of South Carolina, and he's the author of a new book entitled Ending Zero Tolerance, The Crisis of Absolute School Discipline. If you have a question or comment, we'd like you to join us. We'd especially like to hear from people who can tell us a story about how they or their children were caught up in this zero tolerance trend that emerged about 15 or so years ago in the United States. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Excuse me. The rules are applied in mostly nonviolent situations. In most of the situations they have found, research has found that there wasn't a gun involved, that there wasn't a threat of violence. Why is that?
Well, I mean, so there's this interesting moment in time that you mentioned earlier that sort of Congress passed legislation saying, if a child brings a gun or a weapon or alcohol to school, they must be expelled. And what happened was a lot of states, when they were doing what Congress told them, said, well, while we're at it, why don't we just throw some other stuff in there? And so Mississippi, for instance, had a statute that says, habitually disruptive students shall be removed and taken through the juvenile justice system for their habitually disruptive behavior. But habitually disruptiveness means three acts of disruption in school. So literally, there's a statute in Mississippi that treats three instances of disruption as an expellable offense. And so as we begin to have zero tolerance, or we might say three strikes and you're out, for instance, in regard to that type of misbehavior, we started suspending and expelling a lot more kids. And so now, in most states, 90% or more of suspensions and expulsions are for nonviolent, non-drug-related behavior. It's really just a system that's gotten out of hand.
How many children are we talking about that this affects every year?
Over 3 million. There are over 3 million children suspended and expelled each year. Certainly a lot more suspensions there are expulsions, but I often lump those categories together, and I think there's a good reason for it, because suspending a child one time drastically increases the chances of suspension a second time. We can talk more about why that is later, but that's what the data shows us. And after you get two or three suspensions or expulsion, dropout rates go way up, expulsion rates go way up, and juvenile justice interactions go way up. So that initial decision to suspend 3 million or so kids a year has long-term ripple repercussions.
And from the research that I read, and it might have been in your book or somewhere else, the irony of all this is it doesn't necessarily make school, quote-unquote, safer, or it's not necessarily better for the kids who are left behind.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing I always like to emphasize. When the conversation becomes about removing a bad kid or safety for the good kid, it's easy to throw away the so-called bad kid. But the data shows us that schools with high suspension rates, right, so those that are quick to kick a kid out, actually have some of the most disruptive and disorderly environments, and that it actually brings down the achievement of the well-behaved child. And people say, well, why would that be? Why would kicking out the misbehaving child bring down everyone else's? Well, the answer to that is simple. These kids that are being suspended and expelled, they're not anonymous children. They are the friends. They are the family. They are the peers, sometimes for years, of the other children. And when one child sees another child treated in a way that may be irrational, may be unfair, you know, the well-behaved child changes their view of school. It doesn't seem like a place that's interested in them as individuals, interested in helping them achieve, right? And so it undermines the school culture for one child to see another child mistreated, so to speak. And with school resource officers, I think this idea becomes even clearer. And I always tell people, there was this video that went viral out of South Carolina last year where a police officer pulls a young female out of her desk in a headlock and drags her across the floor. Mm-hmm. And so some people come to the aid or come to the defense of the school resource officers and go, well, we really need them there for safety. And I always say to them, number one, was that girl posing a safety threat to anyone? The answer is clearly not. Was she disrupting class? Actually, no. She was sitting there just being non-responsive. Was there a single child in that classroom who was better off after seeing the officer do that than before? And the answer is no, they were traumatized. Would any of us want our children to see a police officer acting violently towards another child? So I think, you know, whether it's suspension or whether it's a school resource officer, we think we're doing the well-behaved children a favor, and we're often traumatizing or undermining their positive perception of authority and the school itself.
Is there ever an appropriate time to suspend or expel a student, in your opinion?
You know, definitely. I mean, there are some kids that do very serious things, right? They, you know, a child knowingly brings a weapon to school to harm someone, right? A child knowingly brings drugs to school to sell them, right? And those are serious offenses. I'm not suggesting we look the other way. I'm just pointing out that that's only about 3 to 5% of the sort of discipline issues that come up over the course of the day. And so, you know, these sort of rare circumstances where suspension and expulsion are justified can't be a justification for all these other instances when kids are just engaging in everyday childish misbehavior.
Also, there's been a question, I mean, as districts have been left to interpret, especially in Ohio, a lot of what weapons mean. Kids are getting kicked out of class or school for all kinds of things. I mean, we hear crazy things like a kid, I don't know, carving a Pop-Tart into the shape of a gun, nail clippers, that kind of a thing. What's that all about?
Well, I think there's two different things going on, or two different scenarios in which that happens. I think one is where we have a school leader or a school board that has a very sort of authoritarian, dictatorial approach towards school, which is, I make the rules. If you breach them, I'm going to throw you out, regardless of whether it makes sense, because what really matters is you obey me, right? Mm-hmm. Now, any of us who have children know that that type of approach doesn't work so well, but some people have that personality approach. So we have that. We have sort of the authoritarian regime. But I'd like to hope and think that that's not sort of the prevalent situation. I think more often is the situation is where no one wants to take responsibility for making a decision, right? No one wants to interpret language. And so the easier thing to do is to hide behind the rule, right? The rule says weapon. This falls in the category of weapon, and I have no discretion to act otherwise, right? And so I think some of it's just the schools are afraid that if they exercise judgment, they're going to be accused of exercising it wrong. They're going to be accused of treating children differently. And it's easier just to say, no, we treat everyone the same. It falls within our definition of weapon, and therefore you're expelled. And this happened actually recently. Last week, there was a Minnesota Supreme Court decision that came down involving this kid who his family owns a very large farm or a sizable farm, and I think they were working with hay, and he had a small pocket knife that he uses to cut the twine off of the hay.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he uses his backpack to sort of carry things on the tractor and that sort of thing. So he had slipped his little knife into his backpack, I guess, to carry it back to the house. Well, on Monday, he shows up to school, and there's a random sweep of the school, and it turns up this knife. And actually, I think he says, look, this is what was happening on the family farm. I didn't know. I'm sorry. And they expel him anyway. Fortunately, in a rare case, there's some unique law in Minnesota. The Minnesota Supreme Court said, look, this weapons rule is designed to prevent kids from bringing weapons to school with the intent of harming someone, or at least intentionally bringing a weapon to school. This kid did it accidentally. You can't take away, a year of this kid's education because he forgot and left his farm tool in his backpack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. This seems logical. I'm still grappling with the fact this is where the zero tolerance comes in. Is no, we have a rule, and it doesn't matter why you broke the rule. It's the rule.
Well, and let me also throw this in. I some people think, you're talking a hyperbole. What's the school to do? I think one of the things I talk about in the book is, one of our nation's greatest tragedies happened 15 years ago on 9/11, right? And we discovered how dangerous planes can be in the hands of wrong people to our nation's security. All right, so that's the context. But if you or I accidentally left a knife, a very big knife, in our purse or bag on the way to get on an airplane, they wouldn't throw us in jail.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't charge us with a crime. They would say, here's a box. If you want to pay to ship this thing home to South Carolina, Mr. Black, you can do that. Or we can just throw it in the garbage. Or you can just leave. But if you want to get on the plane, that's your choices. And I say, okay, let me throw it in the garbage. I get on the plane, and that's the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
So why is it that in a very dangerous situation, an airplane, we don't charge anybody, we don't punish anybody, but in a school situation when a child makes a mistake, we take their education away from them? That, I think, those two examples are very hard to square with one another and argue with a straight face that schools are acting rationally when they treat children this way.
We're talking about zero tolerance discipline policies in schools. It's kind of the law of the land these days. Some schools are trying to make changes. Some districts are trying to make changes. In Ohio, though, they can't, because by Ohio law, you have to abide by them. Efforts to enact legislation to repeal that law in Ohio have not gained any traction yet. We'll talk about a little bit about why that is coming up if you stay with us right now. Still with us, Derek Black, professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law and author of a new book entitled Ending Zero Tolerance, The Crisis of Absolute School Discipline. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. So-called zero-tolerance school discipline policies were intended to make schools safer. An Ohio law enacted in 1998 requires all public schools to adopt a zero-tolerance policy for violent, disruptive, or inappropriate behavior. How districts interpret that mandate varies kind of wildly. Some students have been suspended for talking back to teachers or bringing over-the-counter painkillers such as Tylenol to school. Many critics believe the policy is unfairly applied and can channel students into the so-called school-to-prison pipeline. University of South Carolina School of Law professor Derek Black has written a new book on the topic. It's entitled Ending Zero Tolerance, The Crisis of Absolute School Discipline. He's still with us by phone, and joining us now is policy consultant for the Children's Defense Fund of Ohio, Sarah Beal. Welcome back to the show, Sarah.
Thank you.
Sarah, can you explain what the law is in Ohio and how it is applied in schools across the state? What do we know?
Sure. We have a state statute in Ohio. It's revised code 3313.534, if anyone wants to look it up, that requires schools to have a policy, as you said, of zero tolerance toward inappropriate, disruptive, or violent behavior, including excessive truancy. It does not mandate, as Professor Black mentioned earlier, a lot of these laws don't specifically mandate that schools suspend or expel students who engage in this behavior, but that is effectively what has happened. Since Ohio adopted this law in 1998, we've seen a skyrocketing number of suspensions and expulsions in Ohio, and our data all comes from the Ohio Department of Education. This is what schools report to the Department of Education. So this is collected from them. Shows us that over 60% of out-of-school suspensions in Ohio are for disobedient or disruptive behavior. Intimidation, which is a category that includes things like dress code violations or being disrespectful. And truancy. These are kids who are missing school anyway, and we're suspending them. Which, if someone could explain the logic of that to me, I would really like to hear it. But these are kids who are not engaging in violent offenses. These are kids who are engaging in pretty minor misbehavior. And what we've seen is less than 6% of out-of-school suspensions in Ohio have been for bringing a weapon or drugs or something like that to school. So it's they're policies that are really impacting kids for pretty minor things. And that's really harmful to children overall.
And Derek Black, research has shown that there's disparity as well, that there are numbers that show that these policies unfairly impact students of color, students who are already dealing with disabilities.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the unfortunate realities of zero tolerance, is that some people thought early on that if we just have a one-size-fits-all rule to discipline, we will reduce racial disparities. We have long since had racial disparities in discipline. So the idea was if they show up in the office and we just suspend them all, at least we'll know that African-American and white kids and Latino kids are being treated the same. But what we've found through research is that actually the bias, more often than not, doesn't happen in the principal's office. It happens at the classroom level, right? So that a teacher may be willing to tolerate a little bit more disruption from a white child than an African-American child, or for that matter, might interpret an African-American child's behavior as disruptive, but actually not even interpret the white child as being disruptive. Mm-hmm. So we have bias if it's occurring at the classroom level, right? And then we send those kids to the office and mandate or heavily incentivize suspension or expulsion. What we do is remove the principal's ability to counteract racial bias, that the principal's hands actually are tied. So what we found was that zero tolerance actually amplified racial bias because it sort of mandated a punishment on top of sort of lower level acts of racial bias.
And Sarah Beal, as far as Ohio goes, what do we know about percentages when it comes to children of color?
So in Ohio, African American and Black children make up about 15 to 16% of our total public school student population, but account for over 50% of out of school suspensions. So there's a pretty huge disparity there. And what we've seen at Children's Defense Fund, looking at the data, we released a report in 2012 that highlighted some of those disparities, and we've just been looking back at the numbers. And although we've made some good progress in Ohio, we have reduced the overall number of suspensions of students statewide. The disparities have actually gotten worse in that time. So in Ohio, Black students are approximately 6 times more likely to be suspended out of school than white students for engaging in the same types of misbehavior. Children with disabilities, depending on their disability category, are anywhere from 2 to 8 times more likely to be suspended out of school. And low-income children, in our education data, their children who are flagged as economically disadvantaged are 6 times more likely to be suspended out of school. And that's a increase from about 2 times more likely 4 years ago. So we've seen those disparities get worse, even though the overall numbers are going down.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And Derek Black, that all three of those groups make up disproportionately large number of our prison inmates, of people who are adjudicated as young adults and adults.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the numbers are just sort of compounding, right? Sort of suspension compounds likelihood of expulsion. Expulsion compounds likelihood of unemployment. Unemployment compounds likelihood of incarceration. So it really is a sort of schoolhouse to jailhouse track, although sometimes it doesn't take that many stops that I articulated. But I think, you know, one of the things that people often push back on, or there's this sort of, you know, lurking thought is, well, you know, those disparities are there because the African-American kids are misbehaving or the poor kids are misbehaving. And so, you know, that perception is there. And there's a fascinating study that was published in the last year that really dispels the notion that African-American kids are just misbehaving more than others, and that's why they're getting suspended or expelled. And so what they did in this study was they took files, paper-written files, that described the incident, what had occurred, who had been hurt or not hurt, all these sorts of things. And they had some information that suggested the race of the student who purportedly had done something wrong. And so what we really, by doing it this way on paper and in a sort of controlled study way, we could say, well, how does you know, an administrator react to file number one when the student's white and has done X versus file number two when the student is African-American and has done the same exact thing? And what they found, interestingly, was that the first time a child misbehaved, the first time, there really wasn't that big of a disparity in terms of whether the student was suspended or expelled. African-Americans and whites were treated roughly the same. But the second time a child misbehaved, the disparity jumped off the chart, right? And the scholars speculated or reasoned that what happened was, is the first time that a child misbehaves, people are willing to look the other way and think the best of a child. But when a child misbehaves the second time, the stereotype jumps in, right? The stereotype that African-American students are misbehaving or unruly. And when a student misbehaves the second time, it confirms the stereotype. And at that point, the school becomes far more likely to suspend or expel a student. So really a fascinating study showing that actually African-American children are more likely to be suspended for the exact same behavior as white students.
We have an email from Angel. She writes, my sister was suspended from school in her junior year when she asked a girl who was bullying her why she was harassing her. A group gathered around them and the school suspended both girls. My sister had to explain the situation on every college application the next year and was very upset she had to explain a situation where she hadn't done anything wrong. Fortunately, she was accepted at many schools and just graduated from college. But unfortunately, suspension increases a student's likelihood of dropping out of school. Have you found that as well, Derek Black, the dropout issue?
Yeah, I mean, there's what social scientists often call a psychic break that occurs when a student is suspended or expelled or suspended from school. That, you know, each day prior to suspension, the student has the belief that this school cares about me, that we're on the same team. Even if the kid's misbehaving, even if the teacher's not their best friend, right, there is this positive bond. But when the school takes the action to remove them from the school, it is sending a message, you are not part of our community anymore. And that children, their psychological perspective on school literally changes, right? That this isn't a place that wants me, so why should I want them? Right. And that sort of psychic break drastically increases the likelihood of dropout. And that's putting aside the fact that the student is also going to fall behind in their work. Right. And when they fall behind in their work, it's harder to catch up. Again, makes, you know, graduation, you know, less likely. It makes suspension also more likely. So there's lots of objective reasons why dropout rates go up. But there's also this sort of psychological reason why dropouts go up.
What kind of efforts have there been in Ohio, Sarah Beal, to you mentioned a little bit that there have been some efforts, but what's next?
So advocates are working on several levels. At the state level, there have been attempts the last few years to change our zero tolerance statute that I mentioned before. Those efforts haven't been successful yet, but there's hope that the legislature, I mean, I think there's some good bipartisan agreement that these policies don't make sense. And we need to give schools better tools to address these. I mean, one point that I think is really important is that I think telling teachers and administrators, you can't do this anymore without giving them an alternative that works is really dangerous. I mean, one of the things I really worry about is if we tell schools they can't suspend students for misbehavior anymore, are they going to start calling the police more often? Are school resource officers going to become disciplinarians? I mean, we see that a little bit already happening. Mm-hmm. So the legislature, I think, is really looking carefully at what do we replace this suspension and expulsion scheme with. And so there's a proposal right now that Senator Lehner in the Senate is looking at. She's a Republican from the Dayton area to reform our zero tolerance statute and write in sort of a tiered system of discipline that is focused on positive behavior interventions and supports. The State Board of Education adopted positive behavior interventions and supports as a recommendation for all schools in 2013. And so this would sort of give that a little bit more teeth and help schools implement that. But then beyond the state level changes, I think it's really important for parents, students, and local community members to be very heavily involved, because we can change things at the state level, but unless there's a real local effort in schools to change policies there, I don't think much changes. And the successful efforts we've seen around the country to really change the approach to discipline have come from the grassroots. So I think it really needs to happen to some extent at the state level, but then also in every community across the state. People really need to be looking at what's going on in my child's school and what can we do to change that.
We're going to talk more about what options are out there. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also check out our Facebook page and post your question or your comment there. We're talking about zero tolerance discipline policies in schools in Ohio and across the nation, triggered at the federal level, you know, doubled down at the state level. And now districts don't have a lot of choice in what they do, but on how they interpret it, that's where it gets sticky. If you have a question or comment, once again, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about zero tolerance school discipline policies. It's a nationwide issue spurred by federal law that requires the states to establish a system of zero tolerance discipline, such as suspensions and expulsions for certain offenses. The policy has led to a drastic increase in suspensions and expulsions across the country, and critics say that it harms the students who stay in school as well as those who are removed. Some states are changing the policies and experimenting with alternative discipline methods. Efforts to do so in Ohio so far have gained very little traction in the Ohio General Assembly. Still with us, University of South Carolina School of Law professor Derek Black. His new book is entitled Ending Zero Tolerance, The Crisis of Absolute School Discipline. And also from the Children's Defense Fund of Ohio, Sarah Beal. I wanted to go back to a point I think that Sarah made regarding the use of law enforcement. What do we know about that, Derek Black? I mean,
this is, I think, one of the more politically difficult issues because this goes back to the fear factor I said before. I mean, there are a number of people who, a large percentage of the public, that believes that, you know, even if the chance of violence at school is very small, it justifies school resource officers or multiple school resource officers in every school in the country. I think, however, that the burden of having them there is pretty significant. And unfortunately, just this last three weeks, I've written about new stories of cases going to trial or new cases filed in regard to school resource officers that have, you know, there's no other way to put it other than to say they've acted very violently towards children who really weren't posing any sort of a threat. And as I suggested earlier, the message that violence sends to all the other children is problematic as well. You know, so putting aside the harm that the victim suffers, I mean, it harms the whole school community. And what we've seen is that some school districts, individual school districts, I think Miami and maybe some in Baltimore, have begun to say, look, we need to come to a new agreement with local law enforcement. So they begin writing out what we call sort of memorandum of understanding between the police department and the school that really tries to divide up responsibility for certain types of activities between the police and the school, and really tries to send less stuff to the police. But it's really at this very local level now. But we've got this sort of huge current moving in the other direction, which is there's all this sort of state and federal money flowing to have these people in the schools. And so it's really problematic in my mind, and I'm not sure that the benefit outweighs the burden.
Omar in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Omar.
Hi.
Go ahead.
My question is, how young would a child have to be in order for that child to be punished? And also, would it be also fair for the parents to be also involved in that punishment?
You're asking how young a child needs to be punished in this zero tolerance policy, and also what role the parents play?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Sarah Beal, in Ohio, what's the deal with that?
We are seeing children as young as preschool and kindergarten being suspended out of school for misbehavior. Actually, the national data, we don't have a lot of great Ohio data on preschool suspensions, but national data suggests that the racial disparities in preschool suspension rates are higher than they are for other age ranges. In Ohio, we're seeing second and third graders with very, very high racial disparity rates in suspensions. And the role of the parents. So the point is, the majority of these punishments tend to start happening, as people might guess, around fifth, sixth, seventh grade. It's sort of kids enter adolescence. But there is a not insignificant number of this kind of discipline happening for very young children, which is very disturbing to anyone who knows about child development and the importance of children being in school in those pre-K through 3 years.
You mean these zero tolerance policies reach there throughout the system? We're not talking about high schools,
no,
or junior highs or middle schools. We're talking all the way through the system.
Yes. Yes. And one of the efforts actually going on in the legislature right now that advocates are working on, including Children's Defense Fund and many others through the Ohio Juvenile Justice Alliance, is an effort to stop suspensions for children third grade and under, because it's just not, there's no, absolutely no evidence, no data suggesting that this is an effective or appropriate intervention for a child that young. And actually that it, the harm it causes far outweighs any possible benefit. And that's met with some skepticism in the legislature so far, I'd say.
Omar, thanks for that call. Derek Black, is that the case across the country? Is that something that's required in the federal law, or is that on a state-by-state basis, the youth that going all the way through the system like that?
Yeah, well, as Sarah said, I mean, the suspension and expulsion, and I would add expulsion as well of pre-K and kindergarten children is not an unusual thing, particularly in minority communities, and that's across the nation. There have been a couple of states that have passed legislation recently banning that. California, about a year and a half ago, banned suspensions and expulsions in third grade and younger, and actually last week, New Jersey did the same. And so I find it hard to get too excited about that, to be quite honest. That's what we should be doing, but to me that's kind of like saying, well, you know, the state has banned serving candy bars for breakfast at school in the morning. It's like, well, good. You stop serving candy bars for breakfast, but what are you really doing to serve the kids good lunches in all grades, you know, 180 days a year? So it's certainly a positive step, but I think the fact that we were even suspending and expelling kids that young to begin with shows how out of whack the system's got. Mm-hmm. The caller also asked about parents, and so I'll just give a quick answer on that. So, you know, basic due process, constitutionally required due process, requires basic notice to the child of what they've done and an opportunity to respond. And generally speaking, that only means that the school needs to inform the child of what they've done wrong and give the child a chance to respond. That's all the Constitution requires. Now, with expulsion, the Constitution requires a more formal process. So there we tend to require notice to the parents for an expulsion, because that is much more long-term. Now, some states have sort of more protective statutes that extend more process than that, but the general baseline rule is informal notice and opportunity to respond for suspensions, and slightly more formal notice and opportunity to respond for expulsion, and that tends to involve adults as well.
But not to appeal necessarily.
Not to appeal necessarily. A lot of, I will say, most of the school districts that I have looked at have a right of appeal to the school board itself. The unfortunate reality is that it ends up being a rubber stamp process, so that the chances of winning on appeal at the school board level are extremely low, and they don't really revisit the facts very closely, because what they don't want to do is be seen to undermine their school leaders, no matter how irrational the punishment itself may have been.
Sarah Beal?
Yeah, that's true in Ohio as well. There's an expulsion hearing process that includes an appeal to the full Board of Education. I have not been involved in a case where there's been much success in terms of getting those things overturned with appeals, but I have seen, I mean, one thing that I think parents can really do if their child is being expelled from school, I have seen success in fighting against expulsions for parents, especially when an attorney is involved. I think it's a little bit.
But that's a wealth function then.
Yeah. I mean, it's not something you necessarily think of, because a lot of times these notices are presented to parents as, you know, come have a meeting with the principal at school about your child on this date at this time. And I don't think very many people think, oh, meeting at the school, I better take an attorney.
Yeah.
But when I worked at Legal Aid in Chicago, so this is not Ohio specific, but we had a contract there to represent all wards of the county, Cook County, in school discipline expulsion hearings, right, foster children. And in those cases, we had about an 80% success rate of avoiding expulsions in those hearings when we were involved, which is really high. So even if you can't afford an attorney, just advocating for your child vigorously, like an attorney would, learning about what the law requires. I mean, there's a lot of discretion to school officials, but there are some specific things in the Ohio law. For example, schools have to give notice no fewer than 2 and no more than 3 days before the expulsion is proposed to begin. And sometimes you can get a rehearing of something you might have missed before because the notices fell outside that timeline. And there's some things, if you read the statute, that you can fight back on as a parent. And I really encourage parents to really step up for their kids and fight that when they can, because you can be successful and it can make a really big difference.
Derek Black, there's a phrase called restorative practices. It's a framework that's been seeing some positive results in some places. What does that mean, restorative practices? I mean, is that one of the strategies you're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, so there's two big categories of strategies. One is restorative practices, okay, which you mentioned. The other is positive behavioral intervention and supports, which Sarah mentioned earlier. So the restorative justice, in a nutshell, is the idea that you help the child understand the harm, the way they may have harmed themselves, the way they may have harmed their peers, and try to make that right so that they understand what they've done wrong. And sometimes this can also involve a jury of your peers sort of, you know, discussing the issue. Maybe they decide or talk to you what an appropriate punishment is. So it's sort of the idea of restoring the communal bonds. That's what we're really sort of talking about. It's a much sort of softer version of discipline, I guess, but one that's thoughtful. You know, the positive behavioral supports, which often works in tandem, can work in tandem with that, is the idea that what we need to do is intervene often and early. Right. If a kid is showing behavioral problems, don't wait until they've misbehaved so many times that the teacher's fed up with them and is going to throw them out. But see early on there's a problem. Try to diagnose that problem. Try to come up with strategies for better behavior. And one of the key things that goes on there is sort of counseling. And one of the things I emphasize is that a very substantial portion of misbehavior at school has nothing to do with children who are inherently misbehaving children. It has to do with the fact that they may be experiencing homelessness, they may be experiencing poverty, they may be experiencing hunger, they may be experiencing all these things at home that sort of manifest themselves at school. They may be experiencing child abuse, they may be experiencing bullying, you mentioned that earlier. So that's one good large chunk. The other chunk is that the children themselves are experiencing trouble learning the school material. And one of the ways that children who struggle in learning respond is by misbehaving, right, to try to avoid this stressful situation. But when we begin to try to address hunger, homelessness, or at least understand that that's what's wrong with the child's behavior, and we try to address learning problems, what we find is a better and more well-behaved child. And so I think, you know, there's a lot of positive results coming out of social scientists on how do we get to the root of the problem that children are experiencing so that the misbehavior never happens to begin with, or at least it's minimized.
Now, there are probably some people out there listening right now that say, well, not all homeless kids are getting kicked out of school. Some of them manage to do just fine. So isn't there a discipline issue here? And you just know people are thinking that, Sarah Beal. What's your response?
Well, the practices that Derek is talking about, the positive behavior interventions and supports and restorative practices, are really preventive practices, and their focus is really on creating a positive school climate, modeling appropriate ways to resolve conflict amongst the adults, which some of us struggle with as adults, right? But it's something to think about when you're thinking about how to teach. Because, you know, children are children, and we can't control in a public school where our children are coming from. Some of them might be homeless but have very, very strong family bonds and very strong positive adult role models in their lives. Many of them don't. And the public schools are charged with educating all of these kids regardless of what they're coming from. And so I think that it makes a lot of sense to create an environment where we're treating everyone positively and really trying to reinforce and teach children what it looks like to engage in appropriate pro-social behavior. Putting that in place, it seems kind of obvious, but it's not really. I mean, when you create a culture of kicking kids out of school as soon as they misbehave, kids might know, but the adults in the room might not know that kid who's acting up is acting up because his brother was shot last week. You know, there are things going on in kids' lives that the more we develop relationships, learn about those things, give kids a place to talk about it, that counseling that Derek mentioned is really important. We can really start to become a more positive, safe place for kids to learn how to deal with all of that stuff. And so creating that positive environment is something that helps everyone in the school. I mean, the other kids who see those other kids getting kicked out, when they know that his brother was shot last week and he's upset about that and that's why he's acting out, you know, that harms them as well, even though they're not the one being removed from the classroom. And so it helps everyone, regardless of whether they're personally getting in trouble, to see that kind of environment created. And that's really the benefit of that approach.
The Dignity in Schools campaign has written the Model School Code. Is that partly what you're talking about?
Yeah, I was actually involved in writing that. And it's several years old now, but it does recommend the adoption of those preventive practices, restorative practices, or positive behavior interventions and supports as a way of creating that kind of positive school climate. And there's some great guidance in that document and in lots of other materials that Dignity in Schools has put out to explain how to do that, to show examples of school districts across the country, including some in Ohio. I mean, there are some great examples here in Ohio as well of really trying to adopt those approaches. I mean, one of the challenges is that, you know, we have to get everyone to buy into this. I mean, one of the things kids pick up on very quickly is when there is disagreement amongst the adults about mm-hmm. the appropriate way to respond to something. So one of the quickest ways to lose respect in a school environment is to have one teacher punish you for something, another teacher not, you know, to have inconsistency throughout the school day. You might get kicked out of one class for having a dress code violation, but you know this other class doesn't care. And so getting everyone in the school on the same page and really working together in a consistent way, which makes sense. I mean, we as parents know it's important to be consistent with our kids. You can't let them get away with something one time and then punish them for it the next time, because that just encourages them to test when they're going to get in trouble and when they're not going to get in trouble, right? I mean, kids are smart. They figure this stuff out. The places we've seen the most success in Ohio, in Toledo, for example, we've seen some of the individual schools within the Toledo Public Schools District adopt positive behavior interventions and supports. And they did that because the majority, a super majority of the faculty agreed that this is something they wanted to do. And those efforts have been more successful than sort of a imposed upon but not necessarily bought into kind of effort.
And those practices did not conflict with this overriding state law?
Well, there are still conflicts with the overriding state law, but especially when we're talking about the more minor misbehavior, I mean, what's disobedient? What's disruptive? Mm-hmm. How does it rise to the level of what gets to the, I mean, what you know, Professor Black was talking about earlier regarding what actually gets in front of the principal. I think when you can prevent a lot of that stuff from ever even going to the office, when you can give teachers the skills and the tools they need to address that stuff in the classroom and prevent it from ever becoming a big issue, you really kind of see some of that melt away. And that's one way that really, you know, we have to work on this at the individual local level. It's not just a state law fix kind of a thing. I mean, we could pass a law today eliminating our zero tolerance mandate in state law, and we would still have this problem across Ohio because of the way the culture has been built up. I mean, it's not a simple kind of solution. It's something
right.
that's going
to
take a lot of work.
You can't just go back to where we were 15 years ago.
Right.
Yeah.
Can I throw in a quick small
sure. Derek Black, yeah.
So, you know, oftentimes we use positive behavioral supports and restorative justice, and it sounds like pie in the sky, and the listeners don't know what we're talking about. I'll give you one story, which is my son goes to a public Montessori school, and they were showing us the video of how they deal with discipline, and they have a peace mat. And to make a long story short, when kids disagree with one another, they all have the right to say, let's go sit at the peace mat. They pull out this rug, they put it over in the corner, and both of them sit on their knees, and they talk it out. And I thought, wow. We ought to get some of those at home at my house.
Right.
It's so obvious, right? This isn't sort of like pie in the sky stuff. It sometimes is simple things. Mm-hmm. Give the children the right to confront each other in a peaceful, civil way and work out their problems on the peace mat. It's really sort of a beautiful idea.
Derek Black, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Derek Black is a professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law and author of a new book entitled Ending Zero Tolerance, The Crisis of Absolute School Discipline. Also, Sarah Beal, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Sarah Beal is a policy consultant at Children's Defense Fund of Ohio. Thanks a lot for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.